come to order for Monday, March 18th. Let the record state that we do have a quorum. First on the agenda today, we have Senate File 1337, Senator Pappas, Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals. Senator Pappas, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have some handouts here for the committee. This proposed amendment, actually, Mr. Chairman, I have to delete all amendment if
okay.
Someone offer that.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'll offer the A2.
Senator Nelson will offer the A2 delete all amendment. It should be coming around to members. This would put the bill in the shape the author would like. All those in favor of the A2 author's amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This proposed amendment allows the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals to phase in a new classification for its five staff attorney positions. The staff attorneys currently serve in the unclassified service and a job class which is inequitable when compared to other staff attorneys at other agencies. The change would permit the court to fill future positions with workers' compensation attorneys in the classified service while allowing current staff attorneys to remain in their current positions until there is a natural termination of their current employment. And Mr. Fuller was kind enough to redraft the amendment so that it made more sense. Thank you, Mr. Fuller. And I have with me Judge Gary Hall, who can tell you a little bit about their background and tell you about their situation at the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals.
Thank you, Senator Pappas. Judge, welcome back to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you for having me back. This proposal essentially takes a situation that's been in need of change for the last 20 years or so and fixes it. Initially, the positions of law clerk at the Work Comp Court of Appeals were intended to be short-term positions, which each newly appointed judge would have the right to discharge the former clerk and hire their own clerk. Over the years, what the judges found was that they needed the expertise and the training that these experienced clerks had, and as a result, the clerks we have been around for 20 to 30 years in some cases. The pay range for the appeals court attorney in the unclassified service is rather limited because it was intended for attorneys with very little experience who would be gone soon. We're trying to change this to a classified position that is equivalent to what the attorneys at the Department of Labor and Industry and the ones at the Office of Administrative Hearings use. And it would also allow us the attorneys to move freely with transfers among the three agencies and gain a wider knowledge of the work comp system, which helps all of our agencies. In order to turn these from unclassified appointments into classified appointments, it's necessary to have these hires be done by either the chief judge or a majority of the court. We chose to go with a majority of the court. The attorneys won't be providing services to one judge anymore. They'll be providing services to the whole court. That's essentially it. We have some people who've been around for 20 years as attorneys who are making considerably less than their counterparts at the other agencies. We're not asking for an appropriation on this at this time. We're mainly concerned about getting them into these classified positions right now. And we have a little bit of extra budget, so we may be able to move one or two this year. But we'll move them in gradually as our budget and the circumstances warrant. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Judge Hall. And it looks like this is some language that certainly is needed. Any discussion on Senator Pappas's bill? Or would anyone else like to be heard on? Senator Dames.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Hall, could you give me some idea? You say there's considerable difference in some cases
between the salaries of your practicing attorneys and some of the attorneys in other agencies. Could you give me some idea what kind of dollars you're talking about these differences to be?
Judge Hall?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members, we have a cap of the pay range. The attorneys that have been around for 20 years are in the low $50,000 range. The compensation attorney pay range tops out in the low 70s, I believe.
Thank you, Judge.
Senator Dames, is that helpful?
Yep.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Any other discussion? If not, Senator Schmidt moves that Senate file 1337 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members.
Next, we have up Senator Herr, and for members in the audience, I think we'll take up Senator Herr's bill and then also my bill, Senate File 943. But then I think following that, we'll bring up House File 251 for discussion. We had some people that traveled today, so we'd like to hear that farmer lender mediation. Then we'll come back to the final two bills. So, Senator Herr, if you'd like to make your way to the table with Senate File 340. Senator Herr?
Well, Mr. Chair, members, thank you for this opportunity to bring before you Senate File 340. Senate File 340 is making a modest change to a security provision associated with deeds demolition loan programs. The program is established to provide development authorities with resources to demolish properties for future community and business development opportunities. In the original bill language, the only acceptable form of security for the loan was the general obligation of development authority. The development authority typically have limited levy provisions and modest revenue flow, so we are providing flexibility to the department to allow development authorities to submit alternative forms of security. This will give some latitude to the commissioner to use good judgment in securing these loans. The department and the development authorities are going to have to work through the issues of what will constitute adequate security. This is done in interest of making sure that the demolition loan program can work effectively to allow the redevelopment and job creation across the state. This isn't a major change, but it's one that should result in some good redevelopment projects. If you have any questions, I have here representative from the St. Paul Port Authority, Laura Lauder, and there's also a member from the Department of Economic Employment and Economic Development as well. So,
thank you very much, Senator. Yeah. Ms. Lauder, would you like to add some testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lori Lauder, Director of Business and Intergovernmental Affairs at the St. Paul Port Authority. And, Mr. Chair, I'm also speaking today as the co-chair of the Legislative Committee of the group known as EDAM, the Economic Development Association of Minnesota, which has a little over 500 members, about half and half, public sector and private sector. Mr. Chair, just very briefly, Senator Herr has said it all, really. This provides some very needed flexibility in the type of security provided. We did work with deed staff, and they are supportive of it as well, and we appreciate your consideration of this technical change.
Thank you very much. Members have any questions on Senator Herr's Senate File 340? It does look to be rather technical in nature. Would anyone else like to be heard on Senate File 340? If not, Senator Herr moves that Senate File 340 be recommended to pass. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Herr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
All right, Senator Sparks. Before us, we have Senate File 943.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 943 deals with the Minnesota Investment Fund and the Development Authority's inclusion authorization. Is a small expansion of the eligibility criteria for the Minnesota Investment Fund program. Under current law, eligibility is limited to municipalities. Senate File 943 would allow development authorities to apply for Minnesota Investment Fund grants, provided they secure approval from the municipality they serve. This allows the development authorities to work out the details of their project and proposal with their municipality, obtain their approval to seek state funds, and apply directly rather than through the municipality for the funds. The Department of Employment and Economic Development has indicated that they are fine with this change. And again, I have with me Lori Lauder from the St. Paul Port Authority, who worked on this provision.
And Ms. Lauder.
Hello, Mr. Chair, again. Once again, I'm representing the St. Paul Port Authority and the EDAM group. We are both supportive of this change. Very simply put, Mr. Chair, this streamlines the process. When development authorities are working with a customer, it makes most sense to work with that growing business customer, work out all of the details of the transaction, the proposed transaction, as well as the MIF funding. So it's an efficiency effort, and we do appreciate your consideration of, once again, this technical change.
Right. Well, thank you, Ms. Lauder. Would anyone else like to be heard on Senate File 943?
Mr. Chair, and I apologize. Senator Tomasoni's committee ran a little long, so I'm just trying to get through this. But I do believe I do have an A1 amendment, Mr. Chair and members, that we would like to offer. And I can explain it. We can have Ms. Haney come up, too. My understanding that this amendment would allow the Dakota County Community Development Agency to be treated the same as the other development authorities if they have approval from their county board. And certainly, if there are questions, I believe she would be able to...
If you could state your name for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, committee, my name is Kathy Haney. I'm a lawyer at Fagry Baker Daniels and here on behalf of the Dakota County Community Development Agency. And as Senator Sparks explained, this amendment places the authority for the CDA, the Dakota County Community Development Agency, to be an eligible applicant under their special law. So again, it's a little bit of a streamlining language and amendment for them. We've worked, talked about it with Deed. I believe they're fine on it, although they could speak for themselves. And what it requires is that the Dakota County effectively authorize the Dakota County CDA, the Dakota County Board of Commissioners, to be the entity that provides the service in Dakota County. And the Dakota County CDA board is the same as the county board, sort of like you have HRA boards in your cities that are often the same as the city council. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Haney. Any questions among the committee at this point? Well, if not, Senator Sparks, you move the A1 amendment.
I would do that, Mr. Chair.
All right. If there's no discussion on the A1 amendment, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. And the amendment is adopted. Would anyone else like to speak to Senate File 943 at all? Any discussion among the committee? If not, Senator Sparks moves that we pass Senate File 943. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
As amended.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. And the bill, Senate File 943, as amended, is passed. Okay. All right, up next on up next we have House File 251, Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and I appreciate the committee's willingness to move around. As you said, it was kind of an interesting drive up today, and I'm sure for some of the people, the testifiers that came up, it might be kind of a tricky drive getting back home, too. House File 251 is basically a very simple bill, members. It deals with the Farmer Lender Mediation Sunset Act date extension. But I think what I would like to do is spend a few minutes today discussing that program, some of the things that I think maybe we could do to improve the program, possibly talking about what level that mediation, that trigger is set. You know, many of you know that this was enacted into law many years ago, back in the 1980s when we had a major farm crisis. And sometimes I think it's good for us to, instead of just kind of kick the can down the road, to take a look at these programs, how they're doing, and see if there's any room for making changes or improvements. So I think what I'd like to do is bring the testifiers up so that we can have a nice discussion on this members, and I do have maybe a couple amendments that we will entertain and see what the committee's will is as we move forward. But I think we'll start out from hearing from the University of Minnesota, and we'll turn it over to that testifier at this point.
Thank you, sir. Okay. Sir, if you could state your name for the record, please.
Certainly. My name is Dick Sinise. I'm Senior Associate Dean with the University of Minnesota Extension. I do have packets available for committee members. If someone would distribute those, I'd really appreciate that. Thank you, Senator Sparks. I want to talk to you today about a program that's very important that was created by the legislature in the 1980s, a very difficult time for many farmers and their lenders. I believe the program data in the packets that are being distributed show that the Minnesota Farmer Lender Mediation Program is as important today as it was then to farmers and lenders. University of Minnesota Extension has been designated in the state statute to manage the program since 1986, the year the program was created. The program makes use of trained, impartial mediators who bring together all parties to resolve credit disputes to find solutions. Basically, how the program works in your packet on the right-hand side in the second sheet in is a mediation process overview for those of you who may be less familiar with the program. Shows you how the program works. A creditor with a secured debt of more than $5,000 against an agricultural interest must offer mediation before the proceeding with foreclosure, repossession, cancellation of a contract, or collection of a judgment. If the farmer borrower agrees to accept mediation, that's when our team gets involved by setting up a meeting that includes the farmer, all the co-borrowers, the initiating lender, all other creditors related to the ag operation, a financial analyst, and a mediator to explain the process. And this, of course, requires neutrality on the part of the mediator and compromise on the part of everyone involved. The farmers may have to change the way they farm or perhaps even liquidate assets. Creditors may need to restructure the debt or reschedule loan payments. All these, of course, are voluntary agreements that the parties enter into. In fiscal year 2012, you can see there's an executive summary in your packet describing the activity for fiscal year 2012, and it's a federal fiscal year that the program operates on. We received 2,919 mediation notices. Of those, 44% resulted in mediation. And of those, 1,055 of those notices was completed mediation, and we were able to reach a settlement in 81% of the cases. The total debt mediated and reported in the last federal fiscal year was approximately $172 million. Over the last 4 years, it's been $1.3 billion. A recent change in Minnesota law allows us to collect information on the amount of the initial debt, the threshold that Senator Sparks mentioned. An analysis of the federal fiscal year 12 program data is on the back of the executive summary for your information. It shows that the average amount of initiating debt for those cases going to mediation was $203,000, with a range of $5,000 to $6.9 million. Put another way, half the cases mediated had an initial debt of $203,000 or less. In addition, 11% of the cases had an initial debt of $15,000 or less, and 20% of the cases had initial debt of under $45,000, with 5% of these cases having an initial debt of under $10,000. While we don't have complete data across previous years, these data show that a fair number of smaller operations are electing mediation. I do want to spend a minute talking about the financial issues related to the program. The fiscal note we provided the committee contains information about the federal grant we received in federal fiscal year 2012, but does not provide information about the funding trend for the program and the difficult position we are now in. The program is funded through a combination of funding through the U.S. Department of Agriculture coupled with state funds. The current status of the federal budget has raised concerns about the financial viability of the grant program, and I want to take a moment just to talk about some of these details and constraints we're facing. Since the program is mandatory, the expenses for the program are driven by the number of requests for mediation we receive, as can be seen in the fiscal note, where 41% of our costs in the last federal fiscal year were variable. Since federal fiscal year 2008, the actual expenses for the program have remained constant, even in the face of increased demand. In federal fiscal year 12, for example, there was a 46% increase over federal fiscal year 08. Federal fiscal year 10 was a 93% increase in demand. This was managed by shifting the program director's time to be more of a mediator, 25 to 30% mediation, reducing travel, and using the phone for mediation. During that same period, however, the federal award decreased dramatically. As a matter of fact, in federal fiscal year 2012, our federal grant award was 31% less than federal fiscal year 2008. These reductions are due in large part to an increasing number of states applying for the federal grant without a corresponding increase in the total pool available for the program. In addition to a sharp decline in federal dollars, there's uncertainty about the overall amount we can expect in any given year. Unlike any other grant program I've been involved with, we don't receive a full amount of funds that we'll get prior to that fiscal year. Instead, partial awards are made throughout the year. So in short, we operate the program with the expectation that federal funds will be sufficient to cover 70% of the costs and that demand will not escalate too rapidly. This has worked out up through federal fiscal year 2011 and 2012. However, we can't rely on these assumptions anymore. In the face of expected decreases in federal funding across extension, we face a dilemma in our ability to meet the statutory obligation of this program without additional resources. We are in conversation with our federal partner about this. We have received no guidance from them about the effect of sequestration on this program, however. The farmer-lender mediation program remains a stabilizing factor in the world of agricultural finance when farmers face debt problems. These problems can occur due to a number of reasons, including the loss of off-farm income, high medical bills, or a host of family dynamics that infringe on the operation. Looking forward, we know that there will continue to be, as there always is, some uncertainty in the farm economy. Farmers and lenders are familiar with price cycles and bubbles. And even though we have seen record prices, the number of notices filed with the program in federal fiscal year 2012 was the fourth highest of the past 10 years. Thank you for the time, and I look forward to answering your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Sinise. Any questions among the committee? Yes, Senator Dames.
Dr. Sinise, do you, you're referring to a fiscal note, and we don't have a fiscal note here. Could you tell me what the projected cost of your program at the university is going to be for the next year or the next biennium?
Sure. Senator, Mr. Chair, other members of the committee, I'd be glad to estimate that for you. The only thing I can go on is what it costs in the past because it's based on the demand for the program. So the fiscal note we sent to the committee referred to just the funds available through the grant. When we look totally at all expenses, it's roughly $510,000 a year to run the program.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Dames?
And that would be the 30% then, right? Because the federal is paying 70%. Is that correct?
That's the total. Mr. Chair, Senators, that's the total cost of the program, irrespective of source of funding.
Okay.
All right. Senator Weber?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a little point of clarification. As we look at the back of that one form, and you were talking about the percentage of cases and the range of initial debt, I guess I'm somewhat surprised at the 5,000 to just under 15,000 at that level in light of the, number one, the costs incurred nowadays in farming and the debts incurred in farming, and the fact that in, because as I understand, this was for fiscal year 12, correct?
Yeah.
And then with the fact that, for the past couple of years, we've had somewhat better times on the farm. Can you explain that type of a percentage for that low of a debt, Doctor?
Dr. Sinise?
Mr. Chair, Senator Weber, any explanation I would offer would just kind of be conjecture on my part.
Okay.
What we do know is that smaller operations, might have obviously have smaller amounts of initial debt. This, again, refers to the initial debt reported by a creditor that brought the case into the program. This does not refer to the total debt, just to clarify, of a mediated case. So it may well be that cases at the lower end represent smaller operations and or cases where there may be family dynamics that are leading to some of the need for mediation as opposed to fiscal or business reasons leading to mediation.
Right. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when you say the portion of the debt, not necessarily the entire debt, are you talking about simply that portion of the debt that has, like, at that point is in arrears at that stage of the game?
Dr. Sinise.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator Weber, what I'm referring to is when a case comes to us, a single creditor notifies us. That single creditor is owed an initial debt amount. As the case grows, if the farmer borrower elects mediation, then all the creditors come into the case. What this refers to is just that initial creditor's amount owed to that initial creditor, not the amount in arrears, okay, but the amount of the note, the principal value of the loan. Is what they're supposed to report to us.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Dr. Sinise. Can you tell me what are the underlying requirements for a farmer to use mediation or somebody to use mediation?
Sure.
Dr. Sinise?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the underlying requirements are that it has to be an agricultural operation that either grosses $20,000 a year or uses 60 acres.
Mr. Chair, a follow-up to Dr. Sinise. So somebody could be looking at a $5,000 mediation and have $100,000 of assets. Is that correct?
Dr. Sinise?
Mr. Chair, Senator, certainly I think any possible scenarios you can come up with along those lines outside of what I outlined are true, are possible.
So follow up, Mr. Senator Chair. Nance. So just for clarity on my part, is the amount of assets that you may have in ratio to your debt that you're trying to mediate is immaterial then?
Dr. Sinise?
Mr. Chair, Senator, while it's not certainly not immaterial, and certainly in considering a policy decision, you would need to consider those things. Currently, the statute does not address that, nor are we in a position to collect and sort of manage that kind of data and information.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions at this point? All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Sinise.
Sure.
All right. Anyone else interested in speaking to this bill? I think we have Mr. Peterson from the Farmers Union. If you could state your name for the record, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union. We've always long supported farmer lender mediation. I appreciate Senator Sparks carrying the extension. I, oddly enough, just this past 2 weeks, have talked to two farmers that have been involved in farmers or in farmer lender mediation, one in the Rochester area and one up in the Brainerd area. And they're different types of farms, different size of farms. And a lot of times as a farm organization, we do things. The Department of Agriculture has some good programs that I encourage you as senators to look at when you hear of farmers that are, you know, not doing well. They have a MinFan program at the Department of Agriculture. But then they also have a piece called the Farmer Advocates that are all spaced all around Minnesota that help people, are kind of a first line of defense when you have somebody who's not doing well, and is kind of how we refer to people first, and then they get working with their bank and farmer lender mediation. And so we do support the program. I would speak briefly to this the $5,000 limit. We've always supported keeping it there. Most of our members are much higher than that. The two individuals I just talked to in the last couple of days that I referenced were much higher than that. But we do run into people that this comes up to, and a lot of newer type of farmers, because you look at who's going into farming these days. You know, it's hard to go out into Senator Weber's district, for example, and buy 200 acres and a new combine and tractor and set up shop and start farming. But you could go into, say, Senator Rood's district or Senator Dame's district. We do see people doing these CSAs, wineries, all kinds of different things that are farms that take small pieces of equipment. Senator Herr's in here, too. There's a lot of new farmers too that are that a $7,000 or $8,000 piece of equipment is a big deal for some of those farmers. And I asked the farm advocates. I said, you know, 4 years ago when we had this, and I called a couple of them here just recently, and I said, would we put farmers out of business by raising this limit? You know, would we put people who want to try to farm, is this going to be hard for them? And the ones I talked to said, yes, it would. And so that's our concern. We need every farmer at every farm, every type. And I understand the constraints and some of the concerns the bankers have, but our position is we want to have farmers. We want to have the opportunity for those people to restructure their debt, mediate it, and keep farming. And so I urge you to pass the bill, and thanks for your consideration.
Well, thank you, Mr. Peterson. Any questions? Otherwise, we have up next Mr. Skilbred. And, sir, if you, too, could state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, my name is David Skilbred. I'm the Vice President of Government Relations for the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota.
Welcome.
Thank you very much for this moment to just say a few words. I want to say two things, and that is, number one, we believe that the program was absolutely necessary in 1986 during the farm crisis, but we also believe that it the conditions today do not warrant it. And secondly, I'm sure this bill will pass out of committee today. We suggest that you do modify the program if you keep it, and the easiest way to modify it would be in increasing that trigger amount from $5,000 up. You know, in the old days, we used to have legislative findings with our bills. Typically, the legislature doesn't do that anymore, but this one does. And I just want to read a little bit from it to give you an idea of what the conditions were that sparked this bill. Statute 583.21, the legislature finds that the agricultural sector of the state's economy is under severe financial stress. Thousands of the state's farmers are unable to meet current payments of interest and principal. The agricultural economic emergency requires an orderly process with state assistance to adjust agricultural indebtedness to prevent civil unrest and to preserve the general welfare and the fiscal integrity of the state. Pretty dramatic stuff. And I'm sure all you remember that. And today's conditions simply do not reflect that same condition. Two things have changed. Number one, farming has changed a lot. Mr. Peterson talked about some of the things that are available to farmers today. And the technology changes that have come since 1986 are huge. And one of the results is that our farmers are some of our best and most articulate, literate business people. Secondly, lending has changed. Lenders are doing a better job of credit analysis and loan structure. Furthermore, the equity asset-based lending model has been replaced with the cash flow model. So today, if a loan does not cash flow, it's not made. In short, the program was passed with an agreement to be temporary. In 1986, it was to sunset in 1988, and it's been extended many times since then. And here we are today, 27 years later, asking the same question. With respect to the trigger, as was mentioned in previous testimony, $5,000 will trigger a default amount of $5,000 or more will trigger a mediation. I want you to just reflect a little bit on what $5,000 would get you in 1986 versus what it gets you today. Take gas. In 1986, gas was 93 cents a gallon. Well, on my way in today, I saw 3.59. Mr. Peterson mentioned a combine. In 1986, a TR-806 six-row corn bean head combine sold for $90,000. Today, an eight-row planter combine sells for $350,000. If you were to look at the monthly payments, in 1986, the interest rate was about 10.5%. If you assume a five-year term, the monthly payment for that would have been just under $2,000. Today, it's just under $7,000. So in other words, if you miss one payment on a combine, that puts you in the remediation pool. And we think that's a little bit overkill and shows the need, I think, to update the program. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Skilbred. Any questions? Otherwise, up next we have Mr. Medke, if you could join us.
Mr. Chair, and I just want to say, as Mr. Medke makes his way to the witness table, and I think he's got some good comments too, I just want to thank Senator Daines for his line of questioning, and Senator Weber too. I mean, I think if you think about this, back in 1986, we were in a whole different situation. The agri industry has changed so much. $5,000 in Senator Weber's district today would buy probably a quarter of an acre. So, I mean, just keep these things in mind. And, I mean, we heard through the testimony from the University of Minnesota that they're at kind of a tipping point where their funding continues to drop, but their cases increase. So I think it's important that we're having this discussion. I think Mr. Medke's got some really good things to add today. And, again, I just appreciate members listening and taking time to listen. Obviously, I've worked closely with Tom Peterson, the Farmers Union. We're trying to look for some peace in the valley here, but I really think there is some room to make some updates to a law that was put in place over 25 years ago. With that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Well,
thank you, Senator Sparks. And, sir, if you could state your name for the record.
Sure. Thank you, Chairman. My name is Mark Midke, and I'm president of Citizen State Bank of Hayfield, and that's down here by Rochester. And we have a branch in Dodge Center and in Manorville. And we also have an affiliate bank that has a branch in Austin and Bloomin' Prairie. So we're a mix of primarily rural to small hobby farmers around the Rochester area. I am also on the Minnesota Bank Association board and represent Southeast Minnesota for that district. As far as mediation goes, primarily the reason I'm here today is just to kind of voice a few opinions. We really don't have a problem with mediation as it goes. When we work with our customers, whether they're big or small, we're in constant contact with those customers anyways. So if it's a big, complicated case, as mediation deals with a lot of times, we're talking with that customer once, twice a week, you know, for months before you get to the point where you're going to have to go and start a collection process and go to mediation. So you're in contact with that customer trying to work something out. Then you go to mediation. That's another 90-day process or so. And you continue those negotiations you've been doing. You finish mediation. And then before you go into collection, you continue to negotiate with those customers to try to get this to work out for the best of everybody. Because going to collection, it isn't good for the customer. It's not good for the bank. Nobody likes to do it. It is not a win for anybody. So through it all, we try to work something out. So mediation is part of the whole process if a person gets into trouble. Where I would like to see, though, is that I think it would be relevant or make sense at least to raise that limit a little bit. It's been 30 years since that limit's been raised. You've gone through a few of the numbers on different sizes of farm operations. The farmer lender mediation initially was started out for farmers. An average farm size right now is 1,000 acres. It takes $500,000 to put that crop in. It takes $500,000 worth of equipment to put that crop in. That's to say nothing of the land. So you've got $1 million invested there for a full-time operation. For a part-time operation, you've got maybe 200 acres. A person can farm 200 acres, even 300 acres, pretty easily, just part-time. Have a job in town and do that. That 200 acres is going to cost somebody $100,000 to put that crop in. They're going to need another $100,000 of equipment. So a part-time farm operation, you're still going to have at least $200,000 invested in it. You can get down to the really small little hobby farmers. He mentioned viniculture type thing. Actually, those are fairly expensive. That's on a per acre basis, that's really expensive. So that one costs a little more. But you want to get down to a guy that's just raising some sweet corn to sell on a roadside stand or vegetables and things like that. You might have a, you know, the 20, 30 acre thing. That person obviously cannot make a living doing that. But that person is still going to need to have some equipment. And even if you buy one of these little utility tractors, you're spending $20,000. If you buy a lawnmower, you're spending $5,000. So it's just to try to put into perspective some of the costs of doing this. And then if you look at the cost of mediation, we don't do mediation very often as a bank because we just haven't had those situations. So if we do, with a lot of these laws and regulations that come by, we have to do it exactly the way it's supposed to be done. So we do have to hire an attorney to help us read through the laws and figure out how to do it. And so that attorney is going to cost us at least $500. Not a big deal. Then you look at the cost of mediation from the University of Minnesota standpoint. And the numbers that I had about a month ago were from 2011, and it sounds like they're pretty close to the same as they were in 2012. The cost of the program then was about $500,000. And the number of notices that went out was about the same. It was about 2,300 notices went out. Of those notices, then, if you narrow that down to just cases, mediation cases, because everybody involved in a mediation case gets a notice. So you might have 10 notices for one case. So there was 400-some cases. So you got a $500,000 program for 400 cases. Now, you narrow that down to the number of cases that were actually settled was 160. So then you're down to a cost of a little over $3,000 per case settled. And so then if you're talking a $6,000 mediation and a $3,000 cost for the university, $500 cost for us, it's kind of steep, you know, for you might as well just write the check to that customer instead and save everybody some time. So that's why I think it's just maybe time just to take a look at raising that. At least a lot of this has been paid for by the USDA, so it's not been an issue for the state so much. But it might be something just to look at. That's about it. If anybody has any questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. Medke. Any questions among the committee? Yeah, Senator Dames.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Medke, would you have some suggestion of where we should move that to? Do you have any suggestions on what you feel we should put the lower end at instead of 5,000?
Well,
Mr. Medke.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I do have some thoughts on that, but it's all qualified. So, again, you go back to if farmer-lender mediation is meant to be for full-time farmers, obviously you're at $100,000 because you don't have many people below that. I don't think that's the intent of this whole thing. I think the intent is to make sure you pick up the part-time farmers too, and then you're probably talking $50,000. But I think jumping from $5,000 to $50,000 is probably too steep. And so I think you've got to pick something in between. I think 25 would probably be a reasonable level to hit because then you start looking at what some of this equipment is and what the cost of putting in just 20 acres of cropland, you know, 20 acres of cropland or planting 20 acres worth of vegetables or something. You're still going to have over $20,000. The other reason for that is if that's the size of your loan, you're generally dealing with only one, maybe two lenders. And so you're talking with all those lenders already. It's not like a big farm operation where you have mediation to bring in 10 or 15 different lenders to sit down at the table. If it's a small debt, you're only dealing with one or two, so you're talking with them already. So that's why I'd shoot for something in that $25,000 range.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Any other questions among the committee? Would anyone else like to speak to House File 251 at this time? All right. Senator Sparks, do you have an amendment or anything you'd like to offer?
Mr. Chair and members, and I'm going to kind of leave it up to the will of the committee. I mean, I know that you can see, and I think many of you know that my reputation in the Minnesota Senate has been to try to get people on board. I think that this is an issue that the chairman is certainly interested in. I think by the questions that many of you members offered today, too, it's something that I think we'd like to keep on working on. I do believe that we should make a change to that number, and as Senator Dame said, we're just trying to find out where that sweet spot is at. And I would argue, too, that I think after you hear the testimony from Mr. Medke that, frankly, if you're in mediation for a $5,000 loan, you probably have maybe more issues than than what should be happening. So, again, I think for right now, for the sake of the committee's time, I would just like to lay this bill on the table, and then maybe we'll address it again on Wednesday, with the understanding that I will continue to work with the Farmers Union, the bankers, and all interested in parties. Okay.
Well, thank you, Senator Sparks. House File 251 is laid over, and we have, let's see, up next, Senate File 924.
Chair and members, thank you. Senate File 924 deals with unemployment insurance federal conformity. It's the department's bill, which contains language for federal conformity and housekeeping purposes. I do have a delete everything author's amendment that was included in your packets, I believe. I'd like to offer that at this time. It's the A2 amendment.
A1. Sir Sparks, yeah, I think it is, members, the A1 amendments in your packets. And Senator Sparks, would you like to move the A1 amendment at this time, or would you like to take us through the changes?
It's whatever, Mr. Chair, whatever you're more comfortable
okay.
with.
Well, if there's no discussion at this point, Senator Sparks moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed, no. And the amendment is adopted. All right, Senator Sparks.
With that, in the essence of time, Mr. Chair, I think I would turn over to Mr. Gustafson to talk about the bill.
Thank you, Senator
Sparks. Welcome, sir. If you could state your name for the record.
Yep. Mr. Chair, members, my name is Craig Gustafson. I'm the Chief Unemployment Law Judge at Deed. The Senate File 924 is the bill that is a result of the UI Advisory Council meetings that we have each fall. The Advisory Council is a group comprised of members of the Senate, members of the House, and various stakeholders, including the labor unions, the chamber, and other interested groups. The bill that came out of that, the key is the Article 1 is the federal conformity provisions. Those provide that the shared work program in Minnesota conforms to recent federal law requirements passed in 2012 by Congress. In order to continue operating our shared work program, we do have to make changes to conform to federal law. The added benefit of making those changes is in addition to continuing to operate our program, the federal government will reimburse us fully for any shared work benefits that are paid out between February of 2012 and August of 2014. That means approximately $3.7 million from the federal government will be reimbursed to our trust fund to pay for those shared work benefits. Article 2 of the Delete Everything Amendment is the authorizes the CLIMB program, and that's a program created to help people start businesses while they are collecting unemployment benefits. It's Converting Layoffs into Minnesota Businesses is the name of the program. And this bill allows the department to waive availability, earnings, and work hour requirements so that people can start to do training and work on starting a business while they collect unemployment benefits.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Gustafson. Any other questions at this point? Anyone else like to speak to Senate File 924?
Mr. Chair, and we do, I apologize, we do also have an A2 amendment that Mr. Gustafson could speak to as well.
Senator Sparks is offering the A2 amendment.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, the A2 amendment is three provisions that were originally included in the Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council bill, and these would allow our staff to save on some programming and some staff time just with some simple clarifications in the law. The second section in the amendment actually allows, we've had many applicants wonder why they could not backdate their account 1 week because they had part-time earnings during that week, and that was simply because the law was phrased that they had to have no employment during the period of backdating, and this changes that so that part-time workers who otherwise qualify for unemployment benefits could backdate their account one additional week.
Thank you, Mr. Gustafson.
Welcome.
Would anyone else like to speak to the amendment at this time? All right.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dames.
I just have a question for Mr. Gustafson. We're going back to the A1 amendment. I should have caught it then, but you said Article 2 has provisions in there that would allow people to continue to draw unemployment while they were starting a business. Did I hear that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's correct, yes.
Could you expand a little on that and give me a little idea how that works?
Sure, Mr. Chair, Senator. This program is actually based on a program that was funded by federal law several years ago called Project GATE, and then there was another version of that called Project GATE 2. And what it does is, if you look at the first section, that allows the Dislocated Worker Program to pay for entrepreneurial training and business consulting in the form of training programs. These people are dislocated workers who would otherwise be receiving training from the Dislocated Worker Program, but this allows them to go into a special track for people who want to start their own business. And so the Section 2 of Article 2 creates the program. And it encourages people who are in it to get assistance in starting their business. And then Section 3 is the unemployment benefit provision that allows them to collect unemployment benefits while they are starting their own business. Otherwise, they'd be subject to the normal requirements that any unemployed person who's collecting benefits would be, such as being available for work, reporting any earnings that they would make, and not being working for more than 32 hours in anything, including volunteer work or starting a business.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up, what's the triggering mechanism then, or at what point do they stop receiving unemployment benefits as they start their business or as their business grows, or what's the triggering mechanism to either diminish
Mr. Gustafson?
Or stop the...
It's the same mechanism as any other unemployed worker, Senator. It's generally a 26-week program in addition to any federal benefits that they may be entitled to if those are still going under the Emergency Unemployment Compensation Act, which is currently 14 weeks in Minnesota.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Gustafson, good to see you again.
I served on
the commission for some time. But so as I'm looking at these various different pieces, I'm wondering about how it is that we have access to the federal funds, it looks like, for certain programs. So I ask that question because it seems to me that I noticed, you know, Governor Dayton has proposed cutting back on the UI tax, and then that would go back to the employers. And so as I saw that, I thought, well, I wonder if there might be a better use of those funds. For example, when it came to doing some of the workforce development pilots that we've been talking about, only I was always advised, well, really, legally, we can't access those funds because they're very prescribed. But yet I see in some of the things that we're looking at, there really are other uses for those funds. So how in law does that work?
Mr. Gustafson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff. For example, the Shared Work Program is a special program that's authorized under federal law. And as a result of a congressional action in 2012, the federal government has said, we will reimburse your trust fund for any benefits that are paid out if you conform to federal law. Now, the tax cut is a totally separate issue because basically the advisory council is looking at the balance in the trust fund, and the department made projections on the balance of the trust fund and determined that we will have plenty of reserves in the trust fund to meet our needs for future benefits, even with the tax cut. The trust fund is projected to, under current law, go over $1.5 billion. And that would be the highest we've ever seen in the history of the program. And that's why the governor is proposing the tax cut that he is.
Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, that's just shocking given that we expected to be in the red. So that's a pretty significant turnaround in the last couple of years. With regard to the federal programs, do you know of any federal program that exists that similar to the Shared Work Program, or I don't know if the CLIMB, is that also a federal program? That's part of the conformity. And so in particular, I'm looking at we have these workforce centers that use some federal dollars for their dislocated workers program. And I have a intention to have the workforce centers also be able to augment our counselors in our high schools. Is there anything in the federal programs that you know as part of the UI eligibility of funds that might relate to that?
Okay. Mr. Gustafson?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonhoeff, just to clarify, the CLIMB program isn't part of the federal conformity provision in this bill. It is allowed under federal law for us to run the CLIMB program. They call it a self-employment assistance program. So federal law allows us to run that, but they are not providing any of the funding currently for CLIMB. They did provide funding for Project GATE and Project GATE 2, but those federal grants have expired since then. And this would be simply running our own program funded by our own UI Trust Fund for the benefits and funded by the Dislocated Worker Program for the training costs of the program. Federal law does provide that we cannot spend money that is in the UI Trust Fund except as provided under federal law for the payment of unemployment benefits. So once that money gets into the Unemployment Trust Fund, we can't divert that money for any other use except for uses that are authorized by federal law, such as shared work.
And CLIMB.
And CLIMB.
Okay. Yeah. So, again, my question, Senator Bonhoeff, is there any federal language that would allow using UI-type money for career counseling?
Mr. Gustafson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonhoeff, no.
Okay.
It has to be conformed to the federal requirements, and it can only be spent on really unemployment benefits and then these narrow programs like shared work and self-employment assistance programs like CLIMB.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Right. Any other questions at this point? Would anyone else like to speak to Senate File 924? If not, we have not adopted this A2 amendment. Senator Sparks, would you like to move the A2 amendment?
I would so move that, Mr. Chair.
All right. If there's no other discussion on the amendment, all those in favor of adopting the A2 amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
And those opposed, no. And the amendment is adopted. Any further discussion on Senate File 924? All right. If not, Senator Sparks moves that Senate File 924 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Any further discussion? All right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. And the motion prevails. Thank you. Now, last here on the agenda, I believe we have, is it Senate File 1373?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, thank you. Senate File 1373 is the Minnesota Agriculture Water Quality Certification Program Establishment. The Minnesota Agriculture Water Quality Pilot Program allows producers to voluntarily become certified as complying with practices sufficient to protect water quality. They are then exempt from having to comply with the new state agency rules for up to 10 years. Minnesota received federal money from this program is asking for legacy funds to supplement those dollars. Part of those funds will be used as grants or loans to farmers to comply with the program. And Mr. Chair and members, I do have an A1 author's amendment that I'd like to offer at this time.
Right, Senator Sparks offers the A1 author's amendment.
And I believe I'll have to check with counsel. I think we may have an oral amendment, too, that would incorporate it as well. And maybe counsel can help me with that.
Right. Thanks, Senator Sparks. Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sparks, as I understand it, there are a couple of concerns brought by the agency. One is on 2.8, before the word water, insert land end. On 2.10, do the same thing, before water, insert land end, water. And then the other change would be on page 4, line 3. Delete original, and that would be clear that it's the department can figure out what this was going to do is put a certainty as to when the certification would expire. This would allow more flexibility for recertification in later years or whatever. But.
Thank you, and I would just incorporate that in my motion if members understand that. And also, other than that cleanup language, I think that a pilot program is a good idea. But I think it's important for legislation to stay involved and engaged in where the program goes from here, and I think the members of this committee should be obviously a big part of that. So the amendment removes the ability of the commissioner to expand the program beyond the pilot. There is a biennial report in the bill, and we will be able to hear about what is working and whether it should be expanded to the rest of the state. And so if there's any discussion on the amendment, we could do that. Otherwise, I would move the A1 amendment with Mr. Knopf's oral changes as well.
Very well. Any discussion on the A1 amendment at this point? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. And the amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, I'm happy to have Assistant Commissioner Matt Wallman with me to tell you more about the bill and the program, and he's here to testify on that behalf in that regard.
Mr. Wallman, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much for the opportunity to join you here, and thank you to Senator Sparks for sponsoring this bill. If we go through just real quickly, the purpose of the bill is outlined in Section 2, really to provide a pilot program to protect water quality and to provide producers certainty of that if they attain and maintain the practices that they will receive certainty for up to 10 years, that the program is voluntary, and that it would be piloted in selected watersheds across the state. Section 3 provides some definitions pertaining to technical assistance, certifying agents, what certification means, eligibility of land, effective control, and so forth. If you move on to Section 4, it authorizes the commissioner to develop a certification measurement tool. And this would be an analytical instrument that would determine whether producers are meeting the criteria to be certified under this program. We would be looking at the best management practices that have already been adopted or that will be adopted on a farm to determine whether the producer has achieved a satisfactory score for certification purposes. Section 5 provides for a license for the certifying agent. This is the person that will be actually going to the farm to certify a producer as attaining and maintaining those practices. This person could be someone like an SWCD. It could be a technical service provider through the NRCS. It could also be a certified crop consultant or some other eligible person that could provide those services. It provides some requirements for, in Subdivision 2, some requirements for the certifying agent. Moving on to Section 6, the duties of the certifying agent, really just outlining, you know, that they're utilizing the certification measurement tool, that they have some responsibilities in terms of, you know, making sure that they're you know, doing the certification in the way that the program is adopted, that any violations of that could result in revocation of their license or ability to certify producers under this program. Section 7 provides for just overviews the certification procedures of how a producer would be certified. Section 8 is the certainty, and this is really an important part here. When you get to 4.2, it says that any producer who is certified is exempt from any new state agency rules pertaining to water quality protection for up to 10 years of the date of certification unless required by the legislature or federal government. That's a key piece of the certainty aspect for producers. Section 9 allows for some random audits. As with any good program, we need to make sure that that people are adhering to what they said they were going to. This includes both the producers as well as the certifying agents to make sure that both of those parties are fulfilling the spirit of the program that we have laid out here. Section 10 deals with data privacy, and all of the data collected under this program would be considered non-public or private data. This is really important, I think, to make sure that we have producers who are interested in participating in this program. Section 11 deals with reports, and it would provide that the commissioner, in consultation with the Pollution Control Agency, the DNR, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, would issue a biannual report to the chairs and ranking members about the program. And then the last section, Section 12, deals with any gifts that may be given to the department from various different sources, that those gifts can be used for the purposes of this program.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Wellman. Any questions at this point? Senator Dames.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Wellman, in the pilot program, can you give me some type of idea of what type of practices and management styles or whatever that you're starting the pilot program out with?
Mr. Wellman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dames, here's how I've explained it to folks. Many farmers have already adopted one conservation practice or another, whether it's a grass waterway or a tillage practice or a saturated buffer, et cetera. We would be looking at the whole farm, so you'd be looking at based on this particular parcel, what are the best management practices that are currently there, and then what practices need to be in place in order to reach the criteria for the purposes of this program. Now, one of the things that we've looked at in developing the measurement tool is that not all farmers are the same. And so we need to have the ability to have flexibility in there for farmers to make choices about what kinds of practices they would like to see adopted on their particular farm. And so the measurement tool will be developed in such a way where we're using the NRCS Field Office Technical Guide, which has all of those various different practices, whether it's cover crops or whether it's a tillage practice or whether it's a rotation method, so what is your rotation of crops, and et cetera. And we would assign a score to each of those practices based on the watershed and what we're trying to address, and that would calculate an index for the producers. So they would be able to choose what kinds of practices they want and be able to essentially put together the kind of prescription that would work on their farm.
Thank you, Mr. Wellman. Senator Dames.
I'll have some more questions here as we go. Kind of switching over to technical assistance, stuff like that, will there be cost sharing available for that?
Mr. Chair, members, yes, there is cost share that will be available. At this point in time, the federal government has come to the table with $3 million per year, so a total of $6 million in EQIP funding that will be available for cost share for producers under this program.
And a follow-up, Senator Mr. Ames. Chair, if they use cost sharing, when it comes to data, is this going to make some of their data public data then? As I understand, when you do some of the cost sharing at the federal level, some of the data does become public data then. Is that going to be the case with this?
Mr. Wellman.
Mr. Chair, members, I can't speak for the federal side, but I do know that under this program, all the data that's collected under our measurement tool would be considered private data. In terms of data that would, in terms of cost share, it would be under the same rules that we currently have in place.
And, Mr. Chair, a follow-up, who will be managing this data that's going to be collected?
Mr. Wellman.
Mr. Chair, members, the commissioner would be managing the data under this program.
And they'll be doing that in-house then?
Mr. Chair, yes.
And Mr. Chair, I'd like to go into another area here, certification procedures. Now, as I understand, if you have, say, you farm 500 acres and you rent another 100 acres, you need to get that 100 acres certified, or you can be taken out of the program or be decertified. Is that correct? I think you have up to 1 year to get certified.
Mr. Wellman.
Mr. Chair, consistent with the amendment that Senator Sparks offered, there would be the ability for the producer to bring that that parcel into certification within 1 year.
To follow up, Mr. Chair, and if they do not, then they could be decertified. Is that correct?
Right. Mr. Wellman.
So, follow up, Mr. Chair. What happens then if you rent the neighbor's farm and the neighbor says, I don't want any part of this program as a landowner?
Mr. Wellman.
Would you automatically be decertified, or would you get an exemption for that piece of land that the landowner did not want to have certified?
Mr. Chair, if you go to subdivision 6 under section 3, you see effective control. And what that means is that the producer has effective control by ownership, written lease, or other legal agreement or authority. And so if you are renting a parcel and the landlord does not give you effective control to make decisions about in-the-ground kinds of conservation practices, you would not have effective control, and therefore that parcel would not be required to become a part of this program.
So follow up, Mr. Chair, just for clarification, if you rent the land, just by the fact that you have, a lease on the land, does not give you then that control you're talking about.
Mr. Wellman.
Mr. Chair, correct. The landowner could say, you know, as to their producer or their tenant, you farm it in this practice, and I don't want to become a part of any such program where we'd have to make changes in the actual practices that are taking place.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just going back to the purpose and talking about the program being voluntary, Senator Sparks, does that mean then that for this program to go further, to become permanent, et cetera, that it would have to come back to the legislature for enabling legislation at that point?
Mr. Chair and Senator Weber, and I can check with counsel. I know that they've been working on it. That was the intent of the amendment. So I think maybe you can give some more clarification, Senator Weber, but that was the idea behind the amendment.
Mr. Knapp.
Mr. Chair and Senator Weber, if it basically says the program is voluntary and shall be piloted in selected watersheds across the state. There is no provision in here for going beyond that.
Okay.
In fact, if you look at the report, the biennial report says at the end, it also include recommendations on expansion of the program. So, okay.
Thank you, Mr. Knapp.
Thank you, Mr. Knapp.
Any other questions at this point? Yes, Senator Dames.
Chair, Senator Sparks, so this pilot program is just ongoing, and is it permissible then to just keep adding new locations and stuff?
Senator Sparks.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dames, it's my understanding that this is a pilot project that will take place at 3 watersheds around the state, and then if it was going to be any expansion, it would come back before this committee to have that debate at that time.
So follow up, Mr. Chair.
Dames.
So it is limited to 3 watersheds then?
Mr. Chair, that's been the recommendation that was put forward by the advisory committee, that we would do 3 to 4 watersheds. Recommendation that was made by the subcommittee.
So could counsel tell me what's in the amendment? Is that, I don't think that specifically lays that out, how many watersheds does it?
Mr. Knapp. Senator James, no, it doesn't lay out how many watersheds, but it does state that it's a piloted program. You're on, the department's on record as to how many watersheds they're going to do. The other thing to consider here is that if they need additional money to go beyond that, they would have to request that from through the legislative process for additional money if they were going to go beyond what they're planning now.
Thank you, Mr. Knapp. Any other questions on Senate File 1373? Would anyone else like to speak to Senate File 1373? All right. Well, seeing no further Mr. Knapp, do we have a technical amendment?
Mr. Chair, I missed one, land and water, earlier. There were three places. I knew there was a third, and I just heard that we were going to do that, and so I found the first two. If you look on 2.16, before the second water, it should be land and water, so it's land and water management. And that's consistent with the other two places. I just want to make sure we caught that third one.
Thank you, Mr. Knapp.
Need to
move the Senator Sparks moves the oral amendment as stated by Mr. Knapp. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor of adopting the oral amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
The amendment is adopted. Any further discussion on Senate File 1373? All right. Seeing no further discussion, Senator Sparks moves that Senate File 1373 as amended a couple of times be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Judiciary. Hopefully we've prepared you for your next stop, Senator Sparks. Good luck. If there's no further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
And those opposed, no.
Oh.
And the motion prevails. Well, thank you, folks. The Jobs, Agriculture, and Rural Development Committee is hereby adjourned. Thank you.